IGST 2011 Gongshou, where the idea is we'll have very quick talks which have to end exactly. And for this, obviously, the German style would be very appropriate, punctual, the conscientious and curious. So I will try and wear my German hat. Unfortunately, the Irish approach to punctuality is a little bit different. Oscar Wilde arrived late on principle, but we'll see what we can do. So we have 6 talks, 10 minutes each. The first gong will be after 8 minutes, and at the very end, it'll be louder than that, we'll finish the talks punctually. If there's time, if the speaker hasn't used up all the time, we'll allow for a question, and then we'll move on to the next speaker. Okay, so the first speaker is Agnes Visi from MBI, and she will talk about holographic three-point functions of giant gravitons.
So I will speak about the holographic three-point function of giant graviton, and this is based on this paper with Charlotte, Donovan, and Costas. So we heard nice talks about correlation functions. So we understand that the building blocks in conformal field theories are two-point functions and three-point functions of local gauge invariance operator. So we know how to deal with this kind of function. And now we are working on three-point function. I will tell to you this computation. So we compute the structural contents, so this Cijk, for the three-point function of two giant gravitons and one point-like graviton using these semi-classical methods in string theory, and the dual one in n equal 4 to Fourier Mills by using two Schur polynomials and one chiral primary. So giant gravitons have dimension that goes like square root of lambda, and the light operator has dimension that goes as 1. So we could use this semi-classical method. And the strategy is this one. So we could use as two-point function is given by a D-brain solution, continue to the Euclidean Poincaré patch, and we have to vary the Euclidean D-brain action in accordance with the supergravity fluctuation that corresponds to the light operator that we are considering in the three-point function. And after that, we have to evaluate the fluctuations on the weak rotated giant graviton solution. So we consider two different cases. We consider the case of giant graviton wrapping an S3 in S5, and we consider also giant graviton that wraps an S3 in ADS5. So the action is this one, the usual DBI plus the Bass-Dumino term, and we do all the point that I told before, and we got this result for the structure constant, where K is the dimension of the giant graviton, and J is the S5 angular momentum of the point-like graviton. So we do the same for the giant graviton in the DS5. We have this action. We do all the fluctuation calculation, and we obtain this result. So again, K is the dimension of the giant graviton, and J is the angular momentum of the point-like graviton. So now let's move on to the gauge theory side. So giant gravitons are dual to Schur polynomial that are this kind of object. Schur polynomial form a basis for each n, and they are labeled by a Young diagram, a Young tableau, corresponding to different representation of un. So Shell polynomials could be written like a combination of traces of scalars in n equal 4. So there is no limit in which the Shell polynomial reduced to a chiral primary. So we could write our S5 giant gravitons with dimension k like a Schur polynomial in an antisymmetric representation with k boxes, and the ADS5 giant graviton of dimension k with a symmetric representation of k boxes. So for the antisymmetric representation, k is bounded from above by n, so k over n cannot be larger than 1. So the object that we would like to compute is this one with this kind of normalization. The denominator is quite easy to compute because we have a two-point function of two giant gravitons, and here we have the two-point function of two chiral primary, a single trace chiral primary that are dual to the point like gravitons on the string theory side. So we know this two-point correlation function, and we know these two objects. Now we have to compute this numerator. So the numerator, in order to compute the numerator, we expand this trace of z to the j in the basis of Schur in this way. And we obtain this expression, this for the symmetric case and this for the antisymmetric case. So this factor is due to the normalization, so it could be different using different normalization. And the denominator is just the two-point function of the trace to the z to the j, trace z bar to the j. So this cj could be extracted by using this the formula before. So now we would like to take some limits. So the limit in which the Schur polynomial reduced to the giant graviton, so when the Young tableau is large, so when k is going to infinity, and when the operator, the chiral operator, is small. So after this limit, our object become these two. So this is the symmetric one, and this is the antisymmetric one. Remember that, as I said before, the Schur polynomial do not reduce to chiral primary in any limit. So. Now, this function, that I would like to compute in the gauge theory side is a three-point function of three BPS, half BPS operator. So this is an object that is protected. So in principle, one could compute this object exactly. And now we would like to see if this computation matches. So this is our result from the giant gravitons and the light operator, so from the string theory side. And this is our result for two Schur polynomials and a chiral primary. So we could take the limit in which all the three objects, so both the giant gravitons and the light operator, are point-like graviton, so when this k over n goes to zero. So if we take this limit, both the antisymmetric and the symmetric k, so both the giant gravitons that wrap NS3 in S5 and NS3 in ADS5, approach gives the result that we expected, so the result for the correlation function of three point-like graviton. But for the case of the Schur polynomials and the chiral primary, this limit make no sense because we said that the Schur polynomials cannot reduce to chiral primary. Now we take a different limit. So we say that k over n approaches 1, the ratio of k over n, so it's like saying that k is going to infinity. And we say, here we say 1 because k is bounded from above by n. So in the case of the symmetric giant graviton, so when the ADS5 giant graviton, we say that in this limit the result matches, so the result from the gauge theory side and the string theory side matches, but the result of the anti-symmetric giant graviton do not match, so for a factor of j. But this this mismatching is very important because it's not due to the, I mean, we have some explanation of this mismatch that is due to the fact that the Schur polynomial are not the right basis to expand this object, in the sense that, as I said, this function does not reduce to a three chiral primary 3-point function. So Schur polynomials describe the giant gravitons only when the size of the operator k is of order n. So we have to take our limit we cannot say that for small k the Schur polynomial describe giant gravitons, and also
so there's no time for questions, so we'll move to the next speaker, who is Vidas Regalski from York, and he's going to talk about living on the edge.
I hope the time is not going yet.
Not yet.
This is red one?
Yeah, works. Fine. Let's start. First, I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity for me to give a talk.
So I'll
tell you something of my recent work together with my supervisor Neil McKay and collaborators Diego Correa and Charles Young. So that was a series of work about reflection from different brains in ADS-CFT, and I'll tell you just a few sentences, because of time limit, about current ongoing work on Q-deformed scattering theory together with Marius Delif and Takuya Matsumoto. And also, I would like to thank Marius for suggesting a name for my talk. So what I'm going to tell you, so I really want to consider boundaries in the sense, deep brains is really an important object in string theory. And if not the brains, we would not be sitting in here, because maybe we are sitting on one of the deep brains. So my research thing is, I consider boundary scattering theory and semi-infinite line, and basically I consider Yangon's and quantum affine algebras that in the background of ADS-CFT correspondence. So best known boundaries are D3, D5, and D7 brains. But before going to them, I would want to consider scattering theory in general, because the methods we have considered, they apply for in general case. So consider scattering from a boundary which preserves only H, some subgroup of G, and the scattering in the bulk is governed by a Yangon symmetry, which is generated by coproducts of J. This is usual, and this is a coproduct of Yangon, and this scattering is considered in so-called evolution representation map, where Yangon generators are being mapped to U, J, where U is rapidity. So whenever you have in a bulk, scattering in a bulk, you use the Yangon symmetry, and that's how S matrix is constructed for ADS-CFT wall sheet. Now, if you have a boundary, which in general case respects some subgroup, which forms a symmetric pair, so it means it has this nice commutation relations, we found, actually not we, these gentlemen found 10 years ago, that integrability holds in the boundary in the sense that sum of integrable structures in the bulk are preserved by the boundary. So basically, you have to take some deformed, so-called twisted Yangian generators, you compute some coproducts, and these guys, these generators, together with these, they form a Yangian symmetry of a boundary which has this kind of case. And this kind of symmetry corresponds to Y equal not giant graviton. In case you would have a bit more complicated system, so in the bulk you would have two copies of the same algebra, like G left and G right, so that's exactly what we have in ADSFT. So we have G left is PSU22 and another G left PSU22. And for example, you would have a such boundary which preserves some linear combination. So it's a diagonal subgroup which is generated by some linear combination G left plus GR, and alpha is some map, some involution, and G minus are broken charges. Then again, you kind of generalize the scattering theory. You take this formula that I have written in here, plug in, calculate, and you'll see that your scattering theory shall be completely defined by this Yangian. So it means if you require your reflection matrix to be invariant by Yangian, by this Yangian, you'll find it completely. Another case we have considered, let's say case C, is when boundary preserves all of a bulk algebra. So H is equal to E, so H is equal to G, and this case corresponds to Z equal not giant graviton. In this case, it appears that you can't consider level one. You need to have level two generators. So unfortunately, we don't know level two explicit expressions for level two Yangian charges in ADS-CFT. But if you want to consider, you can simply take some commutator of two level ones, and then you get level two. But it's not enough. You have to add some guys that remove appearance of level one guys on the boundary. And in the end, you take this formula, you calculate coproduct, you require your reflection matrix to be invariant under this these expressions, bam, plug into Mathematica, and after 20 minutes having a coffee, you get the answer. And I claim that this defines reflection matrices uniquely. So this theory that I have considered so far is I have tested on D3 giant graviton. Actually, I should note that Yangian symmetry for Y equal not giant graviton firstly was introduced by Anne Neponeche, one charge, and then we constructed rest of the charges, and later Laszlo Pala constructed like general reflection matrix for all bound states. So similar scattering structure applies to the Z equal, well, here's a mistake, it should be Y equal not D7 brain. Then Z equal not giant graviton is almost equivalent to Z equal not D7, and there's an interesting D5 brain, which is governed by the, in the previous case, the B scattering theory, which is of a chiral type. Basically, you could generalize all the scattering theory in ADSC in well-known examples. There are some more examples that are not very well understood, but recently constructed by Deckel and Ott. So if you have D3H or D3 7, so H is here, I mean that vacuum is horizontal to the brain, or it's a Y equal not, and this is H, these shall be Z equal not. So in the bulk, you always have this symmetry, so this is GL, G right. On the boundary, you have this kind of symmetry. You have boundary representation. If you ever meet such a kind of system, use my expression of the previous slide A, and you have scattering matrix. If you have this kind of guy, it preserves all of the bulk. Interestingly, you have boundary degrees of freedom, so you have some fields living and transforming in vector representation. You use prescription C from my previous slide, bang, and you get everything after a while. Now, D7V is an interesting in such case, that on the right it preserves everything, but on the left it breaks supersymmetry completely. And this is something that I really like, and I like because I don't know the answer. So this is an open question, what is the underlying algebraic structure governing the reflection from a completely non-supersymmetric brain. And also there are two cases of D5 brain, which preserves some different linear combination, some different diagonal group. And what is really interesting about D5, it is the reflection from it is of a chiral type. Of a chiral type, I mean that if I have incoming left and right particle, so left particle after reflection becomes the right one, and the right one becomes like a left one. You can always open this picture, and it's, so you consider extended problem. So scattering from a chiral boundary is equivalent to bulk scattering. So here my boundary is simple, but in case you have some field multiplet living on the boundary, you would have this theory which is equivalent, I hope, to the twisted bulk scattering. So my outline is we have considered various boundaries, and we found that we are rich in integral systems. We have some secret symmetries appearing, surviving from those that we have constructed by Moriyama, Torrielli, and Matsumoto. Also, we have some nice chiral reflection matrices. We have some fusion rules. And also, recently, we started considering Q-deformed case. We built a bound state representation of Q-deformed Hubble model and some twisted quantum affine algebras. And there are still some open questions open. So what are the underlying symmetries for that case? And maybe there might be some interesting relation with Ohlmeyer reduced theory, recently constructed by Ben Hoare, Zeitlin, and Miramontes. And now I want to finalize by giving some nice pictures. So I claim that what I have done is really very close to nature. Anyone knows what's this? This is called Falcone soliton. And basically, the analysis shows, so you have in water, you can make it in your bath. So it really looks like open string. There's a quark, anti-quark, and stretch string with some J5 charge. Really, that's something really close to life. Thank you.
Any quick question?
You said the string can end on a different, but it can also end in the boundary. So do you know what happens when it ends in the boundary with this reflection or integrability?
Sorry, could you?
A string can end in the different, as you say, but it can also end at the boundary of ADS. Do you know what happens then with the integrability?
I haven't considered that case, so I'll try not to say anything. Not anything silly.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again, and we'll quickly move on to the next one. Who is Ryo Suzuki from Utrecht, and he will talk about hybrid nonlinear integral equations for ATS5 times S5.
Okay, so thank you for coming to this Gong show. My name is Ryo Suzuki from Utrecht University, and I'm talking about hybrid nonlinear integral equation for ATS5 cross S5. This is the motivation for the work is to kind of compute exact energy of ATS5 cross S5 or N equals 4 super mLs, but in a simple way. And we'll have a lot of talk on Friday on this conference, but so just quick explanation of the motivation. So it is known that TVA equation would capture the exact energy of ADS-CFT correspondence. And then if it's done, it gives us the precise dictionary between the states of N equals to 4 super mLs and ADS-5 cross S-5 super swelling via this relation. So if you want to know which state corresponds to which string, then you solve the TVA. And this is a plot for Konishi states. And this blue line is super ML results, red line is string results, and this blue dot is TVA results, and I don't give any citation, but there are lots of people, and you will see next tomorrow session. However, in practice, it is difficult to solve TVA numerically. There are two problems. Problem one, its TVA is too complicated, and it involves infinitely many Y functions, and it's not easy to solve it. The problem two is TVA depends on the value of coupling constant explicitly. That means if you think of lambda is coupling constant, lambda below critical values, then TVA changes its value after the crossing critical values. And there are lots of critical values, at least the asymptotic analysis says there are lots of values. And then if you start from recoupling, then you don't know what happens at TVA at large, lambda equals infinity. Then I think it's, well, it's a very difficult problem to obtain this dictionary in general setting. So the idea is to get more simple equations. We rewrite TVA into nonlinear integral equations for finitely many variables. This is a T-hook for Y system of AD5 process 5. There are infinitely many of them horizontal way and vertical way. This is a TVA setup, but in NLIE, we would be able to get rid of these horizontal wings and vertical wings, and what are left is these guys, and if you have a closed set of equations, then it's fine, and because it's simpler. So in another way, this is the equation, TVA equation for the horizontal wings for YMW function. If YMW is given by the convolution of the kernel S with YM minus 1 and M plus 1, so if you want to know YM minus 1, then you have to have M plus 1, M minus 1 at the same time. So you cannot truncate this system of equations at finite M, and that's the reason why I'm saying this complicated and infinite. By the way, this is NLIE, and NLIE, it is also known as the De Vega equation. In this case, we have an equation, a closed equation for finite many variables. And this is the example of NLIE, and if log of AS is coupled to 1 plus AS, I mean, itself and AS bar and YS minus 2W, which means this is, you don't have to know the YS plus 1. Okay, that's closed equation, and you can forget these guys, and that's it. So simple equation may relieve the problems of TVA, hopefully. And then the question is how to do it. TVA in general means, well, not just ADCFT, in general, well, will be formulated by the Miller string hypothesis. It's kind of, in any model you can do it. Then the question, well, is it known how to construct NLI in general, how to formulate? And there's this how to was known in condensed matter people like Andres Klumper and Junji Suzuki. However, their methods were not general enough for the application to ADCFT. The meaning is that they know how to do it in explicit models, and they get exactly almost the same equation, but it involves some proper choice of variable, and you need very experienced to get good equation. So what I did is just generalize the construction in case of hybrid NLIE, and just apply it for, this is applicable for any integral model with A1T systems, and just apply it to ADCFT. And the conclusion is that we can truncate these horizontal wings. And the name of hybrid comes as follows this, because use TVA equation over there, then this is kind of hybridization of TVA and NLIE. So I just explain key ideas, and it's not that difficult. Recall that TVA is equivalent to Y system algebraic equation plus discontinuity relation among them. Then Y system is equal to T system by making change variables. And T system, as you know, is given by this formula. This minus is shifting rapidity on complex plane to minus, and this is plus I. And so this is a quadratic difference equation. So what you should do is the following. The trick of this work is to linearize T system by the TQ relation of Krishyev-Lipan-Wigman-Zavlodin, and this is not TQ relation Baxter's, and then choose a proper gauge invariant variables like this. Here T and L bar is Wronskian's Q functions, and this Wronskian's formula is already known in the paper of Roland Kazakov-Tsuboyan. Okay, that's done. And so I have to have a remark on in generality. We only need Wronskian formula for T's by Q's and good analyticity of Q's. And if you have this equation or equivalently this linearized T system, then the rest of derivation is a simple mass, like Fourier transform and get inverse Fourier transform and just it. it becomes simpler by using analyticity of Q, and it involves no approximation, no undots, and the graduate mass. And this is a rewriting of what I said here. We have a long infinity many set of 1YS, Y functions. Then I use new variables, A and A bar, and then rewrite it, Y via this dot. I can do AS plus 1, AS plus 2, AS plus 1, 2, 3, and so on. Then what I said is, if you rewrite these variables, and if it's a good variable, then you can truncate or sum up all these auxiliary degrees of freedom. And of course, this is a generalization of the Debye equation. So what I want to emphasize here is the physical role of this new variable and not in this mathematics applications. Because in the XXX S-half model, AS and AS bar represent the degrees of freedom of spinons. Here, spinons refer to the elementary excitation of the antiferromagnetic vacuum. It's like if you fill up the state of XXX spin chain from the antiferromagnetic vacuum to the antiferromagnetic vacuum, and then consider fluctuation around it, and there's a beta loops and holes. And from the previous definition of A and AS here, you can just figure out that this one plus Y is composite of 1 plus A and 1 plus A bar. It shows fermionic nature of new variables. And if you call it mesons, they are quarks. Or if you consider it magnons, they are spinons. And this is briefly explanation of why we call A and A bar spinons. Well, simply, it's because A is related to exponential of counting function. And counting function is the count these guys on equal footing, and which is useful to study excitation of AF vacuum. And that's the point of condensed matter physics. So there are lots of questions, because I didn't know what the physical laws of new variables in ADS CFT, not in condensed matter. And then, okay, that's one question. Also, more question is how are more general construction in vertical direction, how many critical couplings, and any implication, for instance, the integral lattice regularization of ADS 5 plus S5 superstring. And that's it. I finished this talk.
One question, can you shout?
Well, there's a known case in condensed matter guys, and it's a PhD thesis by of students of Andreas Klumpa, and he did it in a way such that you still involve this try and error guessing. That in this sense, it's not in general. I mean, you have to think of which is the proper variable we describe in vertical direction and so on. So, well, but I think you can think of it later and tomorrow in this conference.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. And our fourth speaker is John Toledo from Perimeter. And he's going to give a blackboard talk.
Okay. So the title of my talk is Exotic Y Systems via wall crossing. And the starting point is a problem studied recently by Pedro Vera and Amit Sever and collaborators, which is you have some null polygon on the boundary of ADS3. This is boundary of ADS3. And you want to compute the area of the minimal surface that ends on that boundary. And it's useful because, for example, the expectation value of the Wilson loop, whose contour is the boundary contour here, is given by this, where this A is the regularized area. And, of course, these are also essentially scattering amplitudes. This is its strong coupling. Okay, so I don't have any time to really go into the details, but the starting point is there for my project is their solution to this, which reduces to the problem of the non-trivial part of this area is given by the free energy. I'll explain the different pieces. Okay. So it's the free energy of some integrable model. There's more, of course. But so these MA, they're N mass parameters. They can, in general, be complex. So you have two N parameters. And these basically are the parameters that parameterize the locations of the cusps of this null polygon. And so these YAs, they're determined by usual so-called TVA equations, which take this form. Okay, so here you see the magnitude of these masses appearing, and then the other, the fact that they're complex appears here because this is the phase of these mass parameters. Well, actually, so phi AB is equal to phi A minus phi B, where phi A is the phase of mass A, for example. Okay, so this is my starting point is I want to study a specific, so I should also say these equations hold when these phases are small. So it means that the masses are close to the positive real axis. What I want to do is study these equations when the phases start to become large and these masses move away from the positive real axis and off into the complex plane. Okay. So these equations, they describe some integrable model, which is contains n species of particles interacting via some S matrix, which is related to the kernel in this equation. So the S matrix is essentially for this model. So the interesting thing is this factor here, and the fact that there's an I here. Remember that these phases are parameters that we're allowed to adjust because just moving the cusps of this polygon. And so if you look at the poles of this S matrix, here's your physical strip. When the phases are zero, the poles are somewhere around here. But when you start to adjust the phases, you move the poles up and down the imaginary axis. And so in particular, you can move these poles in and out of the physical strip, which means you have the freedom to add and remove bound states from your theory. And the way this enters the TVA equations is that when one of these poles enters the physical strip, it means that this phase here will cross the real axis. So you have some integration contour and your pole. This pole can cross the real axis, which means you need to pick the pole. And this introduces new source terms into your TVA equations. So then, in order to eliminate these source terms, you have to rewrite these TVA equations by modifying the definition of the Y functions to absorb these sources into the left-hand side. And when you do that, you're forced to introduce, cross in this variable phi AB. So here, phi AB. In order to close the equations again, once that's done, and eliminate the source terms, you're forced to introduce an extra y function, ya plus b. And the interpretation is that, say, this pole has moved into the physical strip. This is SAB. This is the theta plane. The interpretation is that this y function corresponds to the bound state that's signaled by this pole. okay, so now I just, the question is, when you start doing this, when you start moving all your masses off into the complex plane and really adjusting all these phases, how do these integral equations change? So something I forgot to mention is that, so initially, your IAB, so the connectivity matrix in this TBA equation, it initially takes a form like this. So let's just consider the case of three Y functions to begin with, which corresponds to a 12-sided polygon. Okay, so, and then let's say we start to take masses M1 and M2, and we start to move them out into the complex plane so that this phi 1 2 starts to increase and can eventually move a pole inside the physical strip. So as I said, when that happens, we're forced to, if we want to eliminate these ugly source terms and keep this nice relativistic dispersion in our TBA equations, we need to introduce an extra Y function, which is Y1 plus 2. And so when you work out the equation obeyed by Y1 plus 2, you find that it bonds to the old Y functions in this way. So I should say also that the corresponding Y system is, of course, just something like So okay, and so you've gone here from this usual sort of Dinkin diagram-looking graph that you are used to in integrable models, and you move to this more complicated graph. And then we can start to deform masses M2 and M3, and what you find is at some point you can actually stabilize another bound state. So this is 1 plus 2, this is 2 plus 3. And you end up with a graph like this. And then in this case, you can do it one more time. And at the end of the day, you some sort of pretty picture like this. So you end up with this sort of guy where this is 1 plus 2. This is 2 plus 3, and this is 1 plus 2 plus 3. And then in the case of three nodes, that's really as far as you can go. There's no more bound states that you can add. If you keep deforming the masses and keep increasing the phases, you'll start removing bound states eventually, and this process will sort of go backwards.
So happy to answer any questions.
And there is time for one question, if...
Yes. So what do you mean the positions of the particles? Yes. So is your question as you move the masses, how do the cusps move?
Yes.
Okay. It's not direct in the sense that if you gave me a set of cross ratios for this polygon, then I couldn't give you the masses until I'd already solved the TBA equations. Or actually, in this case, it makes more sense to say, if you give me a set of masses, I can't tell you the conformal cross ratios until I solve the TBA equations. So it's really an indirect relationship, and I've never in the computer looked to see, as you change the masses, how does the polygon change. But
okay, let's thank the speaker again. And our next speaker. So Stijn van Toggeren from Utrecht, and he will speak on lifting asymptotic degeneracies.
Uh, All right, everyone. So if I could have some slides up, that would be great. In the meantime, I can just say I'm Stijn. I'm from Utrecht, where I'm working on my PhD with Gleb Arutyunov. And today I'll be talking about lifting asymptotic degeneracies, which is work I did together with Gleb's other PhD student, Alessandro Sfondini. And it's based on a cute observation made in a paper by Sergei Frolov and Gleb Arutyunov. All right. So during my talk, what I'll be talking about? I'll be talking about a qualitative feature of the ADS5 process 5 spring spectrum, or equivalently anomalous dimension super young Mills, which is not captured by the asymptotic beta ansatz. So in other words, finite size effects are not simply quantitative. You know, I tended to think about finite size effects as quantitative. You know, you compute wrapping effects for Konishi or something. Some coefficient in front of some zeta function change is fine. But this is really a qualitative change. So this qualitative change is a degeneracy which is present in the asymptotic spectrum, which is not present in the finite size theory. So I'll explain how that arises. Then I'll tell you how finite size effects remove this degeneracy, and I'll quickly illustrate this on two concrete states. It should be a very simple idea. It's just a very cute observation. Right, so there is a number of degeneracies in the asymptotic spectrum which you can expect to be there because you have superconformal symmetry, so your states arrange themselves in superconformal multiplets, which should have the same energies. So that's expected. Also, I would like to mention that if you fix a light cone gauge in string theory, you still have a manifest SU22 squared symmetry. I'll refer to each of these as left and right, so left and right sectors and so on. But this like leads to a Z2 symmetry in the spectrum, basically because you can have conjugate states, by which I mean states which have interchanged left and right weights. Because if you have a state with given weights, you interchange the left and right weights, there will also be a state with those weights which has the same energy. Right. Now, in the asymptotic situation, the asymptotic limit, this Z2 symmetry can in some cases grow a bit, so you get a bigger discrete symmetry. And that's what I'd like to describe. Now, unfortunately, I'll have to go through some equations for that. So we have the asymptotic beta equations. There's a main equation for K1 excitations. It involves the product over the left and right sectors of the Y roots, of which there's K2 alpha each, so K2 left and K2 right. They're determined by the two copies of this equation, one for each sector, the left and right sector. And in addition, there are W roots, of which are K3 each, and they influence the Y roots through this equation and then indirectly the main equation. Now, what I want to focus on is the case where there's no W roots. The main equation only depends on them indirectly, so there is no change to it. The second equation, however, changes rather dramatically. It simplifies completely. There is no third equation anymore, of course. What I'd like you to note here is that there is one and the same equation for every Y root. So, you know, whatever root you pick, whatever how many you had, and in whatever sector they are, they all satisfy the same equation. Now, this means that if you have a set of solutions of the second equation, you can pick different, like, you can enumerate them, pick a set of them which are all different, and redistribute them whichever way you want. You can call any of them left, any of them right. Asymptotically, the main beta equation doesn't care. So it'll give the same momenta, hence the same energies. But these states have completely different left and right weights, and therefore there's no reason to assume that they should have the same energy at all. Yet they do asymptotically, so it's a strange situation. So in short, the asymptotic situation is that you can, in the case where K3 is zero, you can redistribute Y roots between the left and right sectors, and they give you the same momenta, hence the generated energies. So how is this lifted by the finite size effects? So this comes about through the finite size energy. If you go through the TBA derivation, you find the free energy through a mirror trick, gives you this expression. So this is the asymptotic contribution to the energy. And then there is a finite size piece of the energy. This Y function is to be determined from the TBA equations. And the idea is basically, you need the TBA equations to determine YQ. Now, if you have different left and right weights, there will be different equations, hence a different solution, so you'll get a different energy. Equivalently, you can already see this at leading order beyond the asymptotics, because there is a construction for YQ in the asymptotic limit, which gives you Lüscher corrections, if you wish. And they're already manifestly different. So let me now quickly illustrate this on two states. So what we did is we considered two states concretely, one of type theta and one of type psi. There's four main excitations, two roots, two Y roots. They can, of course, either be both on one side or 1, 1. The 0, 2 case would be conjugate to the first one. If you're interested, these are weights. Now, these have asymptotically identical energies, as I just explained, because there's two regular solutions to the second Betti equation, and they're different. Now, we constructed the TBA equations. I won't bother with them here because they're huge and complicated, but they're different, so you should expect different results. Of course, what we can do, and what I can show you here easily, is for example, JS4, where the energy correction, the leading order, the wrapping correction takes a simple effect, simple form. So it comes in at 7-loop level. The numbers are just manifestly different. So you have this degeneracy in the asymptotic spectrum, which is gone in the finite size theory. So my main point of my talk was that the ABA misses qualitative information on the spectrum, not just quantitative information, and that finite size effects contain this information. And, well, what I would look like, what I'd like to say is it would be very nice if this could be verified on the gauge theory side, because it would be amazing. You have two states which have nothing to do with each other. They seem to agree at every loop level until you get to wrapping order, and they are magically, they don't agree anymore, or rather, that's the non-magical part. However, as you already saw, this was already 7 loops, and yeah, that's fairly undoable. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. So there is time for, yeah.
I was quickly thinking about it this afternoon because I didn't actually notice it before, but let me think for a second. Whether there's an explanation for the leading transcendentality piece agreeing between the two theories. I might be able to come up with a technical reason in terms of formulas, but not anything that makes physical. I'd rather not speculate there. But I'd be inclined to say yes, but maybe I'm not too sure. So. Sure. Here, these ones? All right. Is there anything you'd like me to read out if it's not clear enough? For... Well, the question is, there's the leading transcendentality piece here that has exactly the same coefficient. So they are completely the same. Only at the next piece, they start differing. So whether there was a question whether there's any immediate reason I could think of. Yeah, that's a... All right. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I said. I mean, I know where it comes from in terms of formulas if I compute it, but, I mean, there's no immediate physical interpretation I can give to it. So. All right.
Okay, let's thank you. Thank the speaker again. And the final speaker is Andrei Zayakin from LMU Munich. Okay. My sheet is wrong. And he's going to talk about finite size corrections in ADS4, CP3, strings versus the beta ansatz.
So I'm also going to talk about finite size corrections, yet in a different theory, which is ADS4 times CP3. And... unlike the previous figure, I'm not going to have any discrepancies. Rather, I will demonstrate a very interesting kind of agreement between the beta ansatz on one hand, on one side, and string theory on the other hand.
How does it down?
Okay. So just let me. Before I proceed to a more technical part, briefly state what has been done. So we were interested in the 1 and 2 Magnus sectors of the ADS4 times CP3 theory. Namely, we were doing the finite size corrections. What concerns the one particle sector, we get that there is no finite size correction for the dispersion law, and therefore we support the next order coefficient and the decomposition of h of lambda function as Strong-Compton, which is zero rather than log 2 as predicted from the quasi-classical estimates. And the main result in the two-magnet sector is that the finite size corrections, which are all there and which are quite non-trivial to compute, especially on the string theory side, do coincide at least up to the fourth order in lambda prime, which is lambda over j squared. J squared, j is my j momentum or r charge on the beta ansatz sign. So the result of the work is that asymptotic Gromovsky error beta ansatz for radius 4 times CP3 is true at least to the order lambda fourth. And what we conjecture further is that it is true for these 1 over j corrections to all orders. This has to be proven yet, of course. So, and now, how the calculations went. So here you can see several quite ugly Hamiltonians. Now I'm talking about string perturbation theory. So these are Hamiltonians. They're large, ugly, and not trivial to work with. So what we do, we calculate the next order corrections to dispersion laws and to the mixing matrix of 1 and 2 magnet states. So this is the most complicated one. So just don't look at it for a long time, not to get scared. So the first statement, which I already have made, is about the dispersion laws. So here what we get for... for the heavy bosons and for both light and heavy fermions. So this calculation has been done totally on the string side. There is no 1 over j term. So these contributions are finite. So you can see that all logarithmic divergences cancel out here. And only an exponentially small, in terms of j, part can survive in the dispersion law. So this agrees very nicely with what was recently obtained from the BT ansatz calculation. And therefore we get this A1 equals zero. The other section of the string part of this work was the mixing matrix for two magnet states. So among the magnet states, there are 24 which can mix with each other since they are degenerate at tree level. There are 8 bosons and 16 fermions. So in principle, all of these interaction terms are here. And what we do, we check that these mixing matrix, in fact, does not mix anyone with anyone, but it does lift off the degeneracy of these two magnet states, and the diagonal contributions nicely fall out into, let's call them sub-multiplets, of multiplicities 2, 10, 10, and 2. And these are the coefficients in the lambda prime expansion of these energies of the two magnet states. So by now, these are just some weird numbers which don't have any significance per se. So now I proceed to the... Not necessarily. So 768 is not any power of 2. You have a 768 here, I think? Yes. So these are the corresponding states from B to N. So here you can also figure out the two magnet sectors. So these are the 8 bosonic states. So each state has to be dubbed since there is the
exact Z2 degeneracy with regard to n to minus n symmetry. So you can see their energies. And these are the fermionic states. And the energies are here as well, up to order lambda to the fourth. And now we just go and compare. And lo and behold, the terms, at least up to the lambda prime to the fourth, do agree very nicely. So now we can meditate a little bit about the result. Is it something which is rather a coincidence, or is it, on the other hand, something completely unexpected? So I like very much this funny German word which contains both ja and nein in it. On one hand, I know for sure that in this hall there are quite a lot of people who believe that the Olu Beta ansatz is indeed exact to any order of loops. On the other hand, we all know, at least in the weak coupling, there are problems, and one can't be 100% sure. This is some other people would say, and sometimes the both statements can be borne by the same person. So I believe that what we have done is, of course, not yet the final test, but it is already a very interesting and non-trivial test in a physically significant sector of one and two magnons. So thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Say it again?
Why are they all powers of two or three times?
Well, this Hilbert ansatz is organized and strings are organized, so it's. So, what? So you know the proverb, mathematics is like a meal. What you put in, that you get out. So, we put in a Hamiltonian, we grind it, we put in a better ansatz. By Colin Pedro, we also grind it and we compare the result. And so the magnon, the
which computations do you mean?
Well, the prison computation doesn't have anything to do with spinning strings, because what happens on the string side, we have point light strings which go around in the Penrose limit, so it's not a spinning string computation at all.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. That's the last of the talks. They were all excellent. I didn't get to use the gong half as much as I wanted to. So I guess we thank all the speakers one more time, and then if there's...